Committee, the Energy Public Enterprise. We're supposed to be joined by the NCOP, but they're having workshop chairs and with in Gordon's Bay, I think, somewhere there. And we've got then the officials from the department and members from the public, journalists and all that. The long-awaited briefing on the IRP2. We hope that we'll be able to get this. And as members, I'm sure, as promised, because of the IRP1, the consultation process was rushed, and we all agreed that we're not going to allow the same with the IRP2. And then we're glad that we have this period. Firstly, we're supposed to have this briefing in June, but due to the World Cup, we then had to shift it. We thought we'd have it on the 27th of July, but we had to accommodate public enterprise and the NCOP. But we felt that we cannot delay further, hence then we don't see the NCOP here today. We have to continue. Unfortunately, it means double presentation to the department. There's nothing we can do about it because we said we can't then delay further. We need to have this meeting today. But I'm sure all of us are quite happy that we hosted the spectacular World Cup. And some of you, I think, were part of the games. And we never had a problem with the energy or electricity or all issues that are related to the energy. We're given that assurance before, and we're quite happy that the departments that were responsible did exactly that. We never experienced load shedding at the stadiums and the hotels, etc. So it means we can do these things if we plan integrated and work together. But I'm sure everyone was proud to be a South African or an African to have that spectacular World Cup. Thanks, Ben. We hope within that spirit then we'll have the RP2 not letting us down, but making sure that we can then achieve our ultimate goal. On the agenda, we've got only briefing by the Department of Energy. We also have the official from Public Enterprise who's here with us. But first thing first, we have to deal with apologies and then move then to the item. Apology that I have, Minister of Energy is unable to attend, accompanying President on the state visit to Federal Republic of Russia. Second one, the chairperson of the Public Enterprise Committee is off sick. She injured her leg and ligaments. She's still recuperating at home. She's not here. Honorable Member Mabella, she's attending to Defense and Military Veterans Committee. Honorable Member Njikelana, attending oversight visit Mtata with the Trade and Industry Portfolio Committee. Policy Tinto, she's unable to attend the meeting due to her work schedule in Eastern Cape. Matibela, her daughter is suffering from a common illness. Those are the apologies that I received. Are we accepting the apologies? Is there a mover and a seconder, or otherwise you reject the apologies? Adebe?
I second the adoption of the...
You move for adoption?
I move for the adoption of the apologies.
All right. Moss?
I second the...
Okay. Can we then give it then to the department then to introduce... I see the Director General is here, Miss or Mrs. it's upon her how she wants to be recognized. But from my side, I dealt with that very nicely for the last 30 years. I'm the one who's in charge and decide today I'm Miss, today I'm Mrs. Where there are opportunities, I'm Miss. Where there are no opportunities, I'm Mrs. So it depends with yourself how you want to do it, but I've been doing that for the last 30 years and it works for me. And yeah, so I'm not sure the DG, which way, or just Ms., MS. you are quite comfortable, not Miss and Mrs. Up to you, DG, and then we'll also get the introduction from the public enterprise.
Thank you so much, Chair. I would like just to quickly to introduce the team that is going to be that is here today. I have got Mr. Ombi Apane, who is going to be making a presentation on behalf of the department, acting DDG for electricity, nuclear, and clean energy, and Mr. Thabang Odette, who is also acting chief director for electricity supply, and I have Mr. Bevaden Holt, chief of staff in the ministry, and Ms. Chilizwe Ramyazizi. She is the integrated energy planning chief director, and I have Mr. Nkiti, our parliamentary representative, and Mr. Peggy Kumalo, our spokesperson. Thank you, Chair, for the introduction. And what we intend to do today, we intend to indicate the process that we have followed and how far are we and what is going to be the ultimate promulgation date. So if I can just request then Mr. Apane to take us through, please.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Mpiwe Makatini from the Energy, Public Enterprises Department, the Energy Unit.
So for the difficult questions, we refer to Cynthia. Just answer the mild ones. That means wait. wait. It depends how he wants to be called. I don't know.
I'll stick with Mr.
Good morning, honorable members. Thank you, Chair. Maybe perhaps as a start to indicate with your indulgence, Chair, that there are a number of documents that have been prepared for today. Is there any additional copies that are required? We are printing more. The one is the actual presentation, which I will go through. And then there is an addendum, if you like, marked progress report on the Integrated Resource Plan IRP 2. The number of copies, as I indicate, that we have printed, but if there is a need, we are also printing even more. So please, I must apologize up front if there might be some shortages and so on. The presentation today is about the progress report on the Integrated Resource Plan. It's about 30 slides. So, Chair, it's going to be, I'll try as much as possible to do it in a comfortable or at a comfortable pace. But if I'm taking too long, please, I need to have that indication. Going into the presentation itself on the IRP, honorable members, is that our premise is based on a process that seeks to engage the population in order to assess what is in their best interest. We do not purport to understand or to know precisely what the populace wants, and as such, we have started and embarked on this process on the basis that consultation with the public is very critical, and that is precisely what we have done. We believe that this space can also be assessed as a space that is very contested, and we have to be careful that the assessments that we make are not wrong or driven by narrow lobby groups on the one hand, or are of poor quality, otherwise it just makes for a very difficult an unworkable process. The idea behind this IRP is that it allows us to arrive at a plan for the country based on knowledge, based on data that has been collected, reason, and also consultation. and we must indicate that it is not just on convenience or the needs of a narrow constituency. Now, the context of the IRP is that this is not the integrated energy plan. This is an integrated resource plan specific to the electricity side only. It is consequently a subset of the integrated energy plan. This point is important, Chair, because there has been some indication or questions previously as to how the relationship works between the integrated resource plan, and I'll just demonstrate that on the next slide. We also need to indicate that the integrated resource plan is not an operational plan in the short or medium plan. In other words, it is not a plan that an organization like Eskom or the utility uses in order to balance electricity supply and demand on a daily basis. It is, however, a plan that directs the expansion of electricity over a much wider horizon. 20 to 25 years is the kind of horizon that we're looking at. And therefore, it is critical to understand that we're projecting into the future here, and we're making a whole lot of assumptions around the future, which we'll go into some detail around. And this slide indicates the relationships between the different aspects of the energy or in the energy planning space, starting with the on the extreme left, the integrated electricity resource plan, the subject of today's discussion. At some point, the liquid fuels plan, the gas plan are all going to integrate and talk together, and they are subsets of the integrated energy plan. There are a number of issues that this integrated resource plan needs to address by way of questions. What are the electricity requirements for South Africa to achieve the aspiration of sustainable economic growth? And when is this capacity needed? That's one question. What is the appropriate mix of technologies to meet these needs to ensure that South Africa can meet its climate change commitments and initiatives? And how do we do that in a manner that ensures adequacy of supply, but that it also creates a local manufacturing base in line with the integrated, or sorry, rather the IPEP, the Industrial Policy Action Plan? How do we do that at the same time as maintaining a competitive position in the global arena and ensuring that we use our local and regional resources sustainably? In addition, there are certain linkages, on the next slide, there are certain linkages and dependencies between, for example, water, primary energies like coal, skills, sorbents, infrastructure including transmission and land, and these linkages play out in a particular relationship and in a manner that we need to harmonize through this plan. What is the role of the various institutions, including government, NERSA, the regulator, the incumbent integrated utility, Eskom, independent power producers and other stakeholders, in meeting those needs as we build a sustainable industry? Additional questions that this IRP needs to answer is, what will it cost to meet these needs, and how are we going to fund it? What will be the impact on the future electricity tariffs, and would we remain competitive as a country coming out of the cheapest position, or rather relatively cheapest electricity tariff in the world? What is required to implement this plan, and what is the level of confidence in achieving this? We're not just putting a plan out there. We're saying it must be implementable, it must be practical for us to embark upon a capital expansion program based on this plan. What are commitments that are required, and who are these commitments required for? We believe that if these questions are answered, the IRP would be responsive to the needs from an electricity planning perspective in this country. The IRP is also output focused. In other words, it does not start the process with a particular end in mind. Right? So in other words, we're using a fact base to determine the most cost-effective mix of generation options given certain constraints that exist nationally or internationally. We do not come here with predetermined ideas by and large. The IRP will produce certain scenarios to allow decision makers to choose which options will be acceptable. And we'll elaborate a little bit further on some of these scenarios. There is also what we call the policy or the risk-adjusted plan in relation to this IRP. And what it means is that some of those scenarios would be congruent with government's own policy positions, and we would plan according to that particular set of scenarios. If we step back, this slide indicates the kind of approach or environment within which we find ourselves as an electricity sector. Starting with the immediate term, in other words, on the vertical, on the horizontal axis, and I apologize, you can't read this properly, but it's just illustrative of the kind of problem that we find ourselves in starting in 2009 going onward. And we see our immediate challenge as a country being to stabilize the system and to ensure that industry continues in their business operations. Right? So this plan, much as it is a 25-year plan, has to be relevant to the crisis or the challenge that we find ourselves in, you know, potentially due to the shortage of supply as we speak. There is a certain sense about electricity demand growing and the extent to which we have supply to meet that demand. And in the short term, what this slide tries to indicate is that our available dispatchable capacity, you know, is very close. If I can just, you know, in certain instances, if I can just show here on the slide, in certain instances, it is barely just above the demand. So we are very tight as a system. But going forward, you can see in this area here that this curve starts dipping. Right? So this curve, what color is that? The purple curve starts dipping, which is the dispatchable supply, and our demand continues to grow. Now this gap in between here is something that we have to arrest, otherwise it just means that we're going to more and more blackouts. Now, as we do this, there are a number of competing issues that we need to find a happy balance around. Firstly, the issue of affordability. Right? The issue of affordability competes against the issue of security of supply, as an example. We can build more and more power stations, but ultimately that impacts the tariff in a particular way. And we are all aware of what happened early this year as the multi-year price determination was determined at 25% for the next 3 years. On the other hand is the competing issue of externalities. We're talking in particular here about climate change issues. That we could build a lot of renewable energy into the system, it has to be balanced against the issue of affordability as well. And what this triangle illustrates is that somehow we have to find a balance in a manner that ensures that all of those three considerations are optimized. And we do that, you know, within a core of economic development. Now coming to the issue of the IRP process itself, where we find ourselves and how we intend to engage stakeholders around this. Firstly, to indicate that we are at the point now, as indicated under the yellow arrow there. Right? Stage one, if I can just go into that, involved policy, facts, and information gathering. And in addition to collecting the policy, facts, and information, was the matter of determining the process that we're going to follow. We developed a number of parameter sheets, 29 in total. Which parameter sheets I will go into some detail around later on. And at that point, in step number one, in phase number one, we had indicated to the public that we would like to solicit their comments and their input as to some of those parameters. The idea is that in step number two, we would use those parameters. Or firstly, before we do that, we would take due consideration of the stakeholder inputs from all interested and affected parties and ensure that they do serve as input into the next phase, right, where we develop various scenarios. And this is the methodology that we have adopted. Now, the issue of scenarios is very important to understand because this process involves us looking into the future, as I've indicated, but also determining what is very likely to happen as supply and demand, you know, requirements are satisfied. The one extreme in this scenario is what you can refer to as a business as usual approach to balancing electricity supply and demand, where we build more and more coal-fired power stations, and the consideration is a very narrow financial cost issue. That's the one extreme. The other extreme relates to a scenario where we do not build any more carbon-emitting options into the future. And the point is that somewhere between those two extremes lies the answer. What is the most viable scenario in a manner that will balance the triangle that we have shown in the previous slide? Cost, externalities, and the matter of supply adequacy. You have to keep the lights burning, right? This plan has to be practical and implementable, must also be affordable, and so on. So we are at this point, Chair, where we are now saying that we have received inputs from the public in regard to the inputs that we want to use as assumptions. And maybe I can come back to this. But maybe before I do that, is to say that as we look at the scenarios going forward, there are a number of indications or indicators that are going to be very critical for us to consider. Price cone is one of those. We will look at a scenario, for example, which is business as usual, and it will produce, amongst other things, a price cone. It will produce a security of supply indication. In other words, will it keep the lights burning? We will assess the extent of its economic impact. This is what the multiplier effects refer to, right? We cannot choose options and not link that to government's own growth path in terms of which we're wanting to create more and more jobs, and that's what we're measuring there. We will also consider the carbon effects of that particular scenario and the extent to which the generation diversify away from coal. Those are the considerations in respect of each and every one of those scenarios. And as you can imagine, each one also has a range, because there will be a range of prices, there will be a range of carbon inputs, etc. The point, Chair, here is that there are millions of scenarios that one can model in order to determine all of these issues here. Now, going back a step to where we find ourselves, which is the public consultation process around the input parameters, is that through the interactive website that we have put together, right, and maybe I omitted to mention this, Chair, is that the consultation process took various forms, central of which was a website that was dedicated for receiving public comments in respect of these 29 input parameter sheets. Over and above the website, there are processes that are required by law for us to embark upon, including the regulator, and we'll come back to that, but also NEDLAC, in terms of which the social partners are consulted around some of these things that we are doing. And I must indicate, Chair, that we have had engagement with business as a social partner, with labor, and with civil society to the extent that is possible, and I would like to come back to that matter. So these inputs that we have received here are written inputs that can be transparently viewed on the website that we have put together. IRP, www.irp2010.co.za. 81 submissions were received. The 81 referring to differently identifiable entities. Some of these entities submitted multiple comments. In total, 831 specific inputs were captured and analyzed. And they were very diverse, ranging for requests for policy change, recommendations, concerns, questions, critique, requests for information, and so on. Some of the major contributors, and we have categorized them like that, is 67 NGOs and civil society, 63 academic organizations and consultants, and 70 from industry and business. Carry on. We have also disaggregated this in terms of the 29 parameter sheets to where the comments were directed. And as you can see there, renewable energy generation enjoyed the highest comments, 200 in total, followed by the process itself, the IRP consultation process itself. And I'm not going to go into the detail. Suffice to indicate that water as an issue, right, as an external issue, if you like, received quite a number of comments. I will give you some detail around these statistics, but if I can just indicate what, by and large, most of the respondents were saying. Satisfied and impressed with the process and congratulated the Department of Energy on the transparency. Many raised concerns about insufficient time to respond adequately, the lack of input from civil society and communities, particularly the rural communities, the lack of capacity building, which made it difficult to respond to the complex technical issues, the inability to influence existing government policies, the issue of the internet as a medium, that it was not accessible countrywide for those that do not have connectivity. There was also an indication that the electricity IRP should not be completed in isolation to the energy IRP. And maybe at this point I should disaggregate and indicate the steps beyond just saying most and many and so on. I apologize, you can't read this, but I'll try and read it. I'll read it for you. Most of the respondents are impressed and satisfied with the process and congratulated the DOE. Approximately 75% of all respondents indicated that. Many raised concerns around insufficient time to respond adequately, approximately 20%. Lack of input from civil society and communities, approximately 5%. Lack of capacity building, making it difficult around the complex technical issues, approximately 4%. Inability to influence existing government policies or decisions already in place, approximately 30%. Not accessible countrywide and internet-driven as a complaint, approximately 10%. Some respondents indicated the IRP should not be completed in isolation from the energy IRP. That's a spelling mistake. It's approximately 10%. And then most respondents call for a low-carbon economy and for a thrust to be on renewable energy, including wind, solar, geothermal, etc., in the future, approximately 85%. Many respondents strongly opposed to nuclear and coal as energy solutions in the future, approximately 45%. We'll go back. Those are some of, or rather that's, if you like, some statistics that we have drawn around, you know, the respondents from the responses from interested and affected parties. And you are welcome to do the same analysis if you like, because all of this information is sitting on those 831 comments that we have received. There was an issue around the cost of financing the expansion plan as a key driver, particularly given the anticipated difficulty of getting financing for coal and nuclear in the future. Certain respondents included references in support of their energy preferences, but this tended to be contradicted by input from other respondents, and sometimes by the same respondents, where, for example, somebody wanted to really have the cake and to eat it as well. The issue, as an example here, of wind versus CSP in the cost debate, we can elaborate in a lot more detail around that. But I think the point here is that we're just trying to illustrate the importance of finding a balance between some of these competing requirements. There was some indication that we need to consider new technologies, particularly because we're looking into the future, 25 years, that there might be new technologies on the horizon and that the IRP has to be alive to these technologies. And solar hydrogen technology was a particular example. And that we had to consider that as a theme. Moving on, was the issue around the structure of the electricity market itself, that we needed to put in place certain incentives to encourage independent power producers into the sector. In other words, non-ESCOM generation. One of the other observations that we encountered, or rather that we want to highlight, relates to the general lack of confusion and lack of discrimination between what we regard as inputs, outcomes, policy, regulating instruments, constraints, etc., etc. Right? That we have mapped out a process, and the process, much as it is outcomes-driven, the process considers certain inputs in order to arrive at the output. And some people wanted to if you like, parachute straight to those outcomes without going through input. And we must indicate that you know, that's not what we're intending to do. It's not a premeditated kind of process beyond that risk adjustment that I mentioned earlier on. There were calls for water and other infrastructure, including roads, to be resolved or to be considered to the extent that these are serious constraints. Just in terms of other inputs beyond these major themes was the constitutional issue around the state's obligation towards safe energy choices. There was reference to the socioeconomic effects of the decisions that we would be making, hence the reference earlier on to one of these parameters that we're going to be watching closely being the economic multipliers issue. Economic modeling is an integral aspect of this IRP process, and perhaps I did not indicate that strongly enough. But each and every one of those scenarios, without repeating myself, would be considered from that perspective as well. There was a lot of input around the issue of externalities itself, to the extent that it needed to be addressed one way or the other. The matter of human development as we do this, right, that when we look at, if you like, the success of the process and economic growth, etc., we have to tie that to a human development index, you know, to indicate that we're also taking society on board as we grow the economy in the manner that they develop. Over and above water and roads, as a constraint that I had mentioned, is the matter of transmission infrastructure, particularly to the extent that in certain areas transmission is a serious constraint. The matter of the cost of inaction in relation to climate change. Remember the triangle? That on the one hand, you know, you might want to have that balance between those competing parameters. But equally, if we don't do anything, what is the potential cost of that inaction? How we have dealt with these input comments is that they have been incorporated into a database. And perhaps, Chair, at this point, to illustrate that, we have run a number of copies of those comments, if you like. They are available on the internet, but we've also printed a few of them so that you can see precisely how we have dealt with those. In respect of each parameter, we have given reasons to the extent that this parameter is quantifiable. We have given reasons around how we have treated each and every one of those ranges, and we have updated and included that on the web. We have also given consideration to, by way of responses, in respect of those parameters that are not quantifiable. Some of them are qualitative, and we have indicated to some detail how we've dealt with those. There are certain critical aspects of technology costs and viability that we need to flag here as being, if you like, contentious. I think down the line, when we give an example, we will illustrate that, because the cost of technology as a contested matter can influence the choices that we would make, and it would be interesting for us to indicate to you how we have dealt with that. Chair, I must indicate that by and large, excuse me, worth and all, we are quite comfortable that the public that has participated in this process has really relished it and has indicated that we need to continue using it in the long-term planning with, obviously, more and more improvement. And on this point, Chair, I need to also indicate that we must dispel this misconception about the IRP being fixed for 25 years. It is not cast in stone. The intention is that the IRP will be reviewed regularly, and as I indicated, because of the supply-demand problem that we currently find ourselves in, it is very likely that we're going to find it necessary to revisit the IRP even as early as next year or the year later. And hopefully through this process, we'll be able to improve on some of these matters that might not have been dealt with appropriately. Chair, this next one is a demonstration, is this slide. This slide illustrates, for example, how we have dealt with the matter of discount rates, climate change, and price elasticity of demand, because we think these are very hot topics. But perhaps, Chair, in the interest of time, I would like to elaborate a little bit on the climate change issues. And, Chair, it is, if I can indicate again, that it is in your pack. We have just summarized some of the approach that we have used. Insofar as climate change, you might be aware that government embarked upon a process, and cabinet approved a process or an instrument called the long-term mitigation scenario, right, where we considered a number of options available to South Africa going forward in the climate change debate. You might also be aware of some of the pronouncements that the President made in Copenhagen, was it late last year, and the conditionalities around some of those targets that had been set. And we need to indicate and underscore the fact that as we speak, those conditionalities have not been satisfied. We're currently in negotiation with at different levels in order to consider, you know, what the impact will be on those. And it consequently became a matter of default for us to use the LTMS as a basis of dealing with the climate change issues, over and above us trying to find a balance between those competing issues in the triangle. There were inputs that related to the fact that we need to, that in relation to what is required by science for emissions, right, that we need to set a specific peak target of around 235 megatons per annum. And the basis, if I can, or rather the starting point, if I can just indicate, is that we're currently sitting at about 500 million tons per annum. Right? That in response to such suggestions, we're saying that the LTMS is an instrument that will be considered in the IRP. The matter of carbon emissions and the cost thereof, and how we deal with those in this formulation of the IRP, is that there was a suggestion that this means that nuclear, along with the Kyoto, or in line with the Kyoto Protocol approach, so the input goes, should be excluded from carbon mitigation measures. Right? That's a position that has been put forward by way of example. And our response has been that, yes, one of the scenarios that we need to look at includes carbon taxes, so that we're able to then provide a proxy to what is called a shadow price for CO2 emissions. And that's the way that we intend to deal with some of these positions. 42% by 2025 as a hard constraint rather than a scenario, right, is one of the positions that is very contentious. And as I indicated, it came, much as it was announced by the president, it came with certain conditions. And some of the conditions included availability of funding, transfer of relevant technologies from the developed countries to the developing countries, and so on. And therefore, in response to that, we have indicated that the IRPSA decision-making process will need to identify the impacts of those options that we have chosen. So basically what it means in a nutshell is that we can model it and we will look at the impact. So it will be subjected to the same consideration of balancing the triangle that we made reference to earlier on. Okay, Chair, maybe with your indulgence, I'm going to move a lot faster because I don't believe that I need to go into each and every one. Suffice to say that each and every one of these input parameters is detailed in the submission that we have. Carry on. Just on the issue of water, the issue of water, as I've indicated, is a very key element as a potential constraint to some of these choices that we might make. And the extent to which we quantify how much water gets used in each and every one of the technologies becomes very, very contentious. On the one hand, people argue that we cannot use coal because it requires a whole lot of water and we don't have that water, so the argument goes. Right? And we wanting to indicate here that EPRI is the basis. EPRI is a, if you like, a utility-dominated, independent technology organization that is based in the United States. And what they do is they take all the parameters from different utilities into a database as to, if you like, cost for different technologies, you know, operations kind of parameters, and so on. And we believe that it takes the heat out of some of these different assumptions that people want to make around how much water and what it costs and so on, around those issues that ultimately influences the choices that we would make. The issue of the cost of water over and above its usage. In other words, the cost of providing the infrastructure to those areas that need the water, right, is something that we need to know and is something that we need to quantify as well. So that when we're wanting to put a power station in a particular area, the cost of the water has to be added to the base cost as an approach. Otherwise, what tends to happen is that you find a situation where we underestimate or we under inflate, if you like, the relative cost of the different approaches. We thought that it would be very critical that we have the same basis as to how we treated the water approach. In fact, insofar as all new coal-fired power stations are concerned, that they will be dry cooled as an assumption, so we would use the cost that relate to dry cooling, but also with what is called FGD, flue gas desulfurization technology, as an emissions mitigant. And that is the way that water is being dealt with. You can have a lot more detail of that in the presentation. Sorry, in the back. Chair, very quickly, renewable energy is that we're using the EPRI report as well, because renewable energy is not as advanced in this country, so we do not have a database going backwards as to what costs are, so we're using the EPRI approach to it. The matter of critical consideration here relates to what is called capacity factors. In other words, to what extent can one rely on wind or sun in the day right? Is it 20% of the time? Is it 50% of the time? And so those matters are very critical in the manner that as we consider how to choose all of those things. Okay, I've covered the issue of climate change. I think I have. Let me just go back. Sorry, someone else here. That in so just to close this climate change approach is to indicate that we are using a number of scenarios, therefore, because of this debate and the fact that LTMS provides a basis and is endorsed by Cabinet, we're looking at a number of scenarios insofar as this is concerned, starting, for an example, with a reduction from 500 to 275 megatons of emissions across the 25 years as the one option, and going all the way down to a scenario based on the pronouncements of the president in Copenhagen. So we do consider that as well, right, that we model a scenario based on what we had committed in Copenhagen with all of its conditionalities. Okay, we also consider imports. I think this is very important, that there are neighboring country opportunities that can be cleaner, and there are certain projects that might, if you like, dilute our emissions portfolio because they are based on wind. They're based on hydro largely. Demand side management and energy efficiency going together, very, very critical that as we build supply side options, we are intending to introduce demand side as an energy, as a virtual power plant, right? The notion of what is called first fuel. We will not only build power stations, we will also take off from the grid as part of balancing supply and demand. The issue of energy availability, this is the utility's operational efficiency, if you like. In other words, the energy that gets produced, how much of it is available in a year, you know, for lack of a better illustration. And this matter is very contentious because, in fact, what we have assessed as a country is that a 1% drop in energy availability factor provides a shortfall of about 600 megawatts. So it's quite important that the power stations become more and more efficient, more and more available, and so on. I will not go into the detail around the renewable energy assumptions that have been made, Chair, regarding wind, concentrating solar, PV, biomass, and pump storage. What we're doing on the slide is we're indicating how we have dealt with each and every one of those. Just in terms of the dates, relative to where we find ourselves, is that the base case that has been put together by the department, if you peg that as a date of the 22nd of July, in other words, about 2 weeks ago, right? Remember that the yellow triangle that I indicated earlier on is that we're saying that in July, we're wanting to start the modeling of the base case, right? You remember the spectrum. On the one side of the spectrum is the base case, the business as usual. There is absolutely no contestation around that matter, right? On the other extreme is a no-carbon scenario, and there are millions of scenarios in between. So what we're saying is that we're wanting to start with the modeling of the base case scenario so that we can then be able to set out a set of criteria that would allow us to evaluate the different scenarios. If I can just repeat. We will be modeling a whole set of scenarios across the spectrum, one side being the business as usual code, the other side being a carbon constraint scenario. In respect of each and every one of these scenarios, We need to have a basis upon which we say that is the scenario that we should be planning for. And we're saying those criteria need to be evaluated in relation to the base case within the next 2 weeks. Over and above the scenario being modeled, as I indicated, we're wanting to look at the economic impact of that scenario, and we're wanting to do that in respect of the base case. Sometime in August, towards the end of August, we should be ready with the base case, including, or base case as a scenario, including its economic impact. We would also, at that point, before we start embarking on the modeling of those scenarios, want to convene another set of public engagements which go beyond the internet. Right? I omitted to indicate that over and above the internet and over and above those statutory consultations that have taken place, we convened, if you like, a plenary session in Pretoria on the 7th and the 8th of July in terms of which stakeholders could stand on a platform and make formal input as to any matter relating to the input parameter sheets or the process and so on. And our intention is that we are wanting to convene again at the end of August, early in September, in order to take another round of consultation. Because the idea is that we would have already done some work in relation to the base case, we would already have a position that indicates what those criteria are that we're going to use. We would already have indicated we can indicate at that point what scenarios we would like to model before we do the actual modeling. The public would then have a month to make their comments. And this is now where reference to the other statutory requirement kicks in, that we would then convene further public hearings under the auspices of the regulator, because the law requires that we must do this in consultation with NERSA. And the idea is that we would, once the comments have closed, we would then convene those public hearings with NERSA, and that would then constitute the draft of the IRP. There is a process with the executive that we need to embark upon as well, in terms of which cabinet has to consider, you know, the draft, and to also indicate, you know, what the direction should be around that. But the intention is that by the middle of November this year, everything should have been in place to allow us to promulgate the integrated resource plan. Chair, I need to indicate that the one issue that we did not address, perhaps, is the manner in which the IRP process is being undertaken, or rather the whole process is being run, and how this impacts other decisions in the energy space. By law, NERSA needs to make licensing decisions. NERSA cannot make any decisions outside of this plan. If this plan does not get promulgated this year, what it means is that we're deferring investment decisions to the next year. And contrary to what some people might want to believe, we are really eager to balance those two parameters, if you like. On the one hand, a public consultation process. On the other, the security of electricity supply in this country, to the extent that investment decisions, particularly for renewable energy, particularly for the next base load power station, are getting very tight, and we need to make those decisions very urgently. And Chair, maybe we should conclude on the basis that, you know, it's those tough choices that we have to make. We believe that this is a matter that is aligned or that can impact economic growth in this country. We get this wrong for whatever reason, then we could result in stagnation. Energy has been identified. In fact, there was an analysis last week, I think, I don't know if honorable members saw it in the newspapers, around some of the constraints to economic growth in the country, and energy was the second highest rank. The issue of clean technologies in relation to direct capital costs, right, is a matter that we're considering, and we're also recognizing that those direct costs are high relatively. There is reference here. We make reference to the commitment in Copenhagen earlier on, but we also need to indicate that we are still trying to negotiate some of those funding commitments that the developed world has made. We also need to indicate that the IRP must provide the insight into how South Africa can deliver the requisite electricity for economic growth, but to also do that in a manner that is affordable, so that we continue to become internationally competitive. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Acting DDG, with the very comprehensive input. Are there any additions from the department? Energy, public enterprise? Nothing. He covered all. All right. We'll now have to move into questions, answer, or deliberation session. We've got the whole day, actually. It's 10 to 1. But should we not finish, we are allowed to continue after lunch. That will depend entirely on the members, whether they want to do that or the time will be sufficient enough to cover all these issues. 20 past 11 on my watch, so I'll be directed by yourselves then as to how you want to proceed. Can I then get the indications? But I must say that there's no provision for lunch. Members will go and have their lunch and come back, should we need to come back after lunch. Due to the shoestring budget we have, we cannot have that because there's an ordinary committee meeting, not here. I hope you will understand that part. If need be, we can go and come back. It seems no indication. Members are happy with the integrated resource plan. I was looking this at the internet, and I'm turning back to them to say, hey, good luck. No lunch. Lunch. If we have to come back, members will have to go on lunch and then they will come back to the two, but we'll see as we move. I see Honorable Member Mukwena, Freyleng, and okay. And then Ross, Dexter, Hadid. Going off. This is the first round, eh? Then I'm sure we will have the responses. We'll come back to the second round. Can you then go on in terms of, can you start in that order? I'm sure that will help us. Then we come back. Mukwena, you are the first one.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. firstly, I want to welcome a very comprehensive presentation on the IRP 2. It's long overdue, and I think we must also congratulate this particular committee on energy for having brought us to this stage. I think we still have a long way to go, but at least there's something that one could view as palpable as far as policy formulation is concerned, and that makes it easy for exercise of oversight. Having said that, I'm glad to hear that NERSA is going to be involved, but I sense the absence of a real integrated participation, especially from the core stakeholders that are ESCOM itself, NERSA, EDI, and so on. I don't seem to have a sense that there's been an internal, a very strong, coherent consultation. I hear that quite a lot of work has been done in terms of public participation outside the core thing. So the internal thing seems to be missing. My worry is that if we move very, very fast, and I'm not saying we must procrastinate, we must move fast, but I don't think we must move fast at the expense of internal consultation, intrinsic consultation, because what will happen is that now we'll run the problem, we'll run into the trap of a silo approach where ESCOM might be having another approach, et cetera, et cetera. That what is, unless I miss that. So I'm stringing that under correction. The other thing is that the time horizon of 20 to 25 years, I know it can't be very concrete, but to what extent is that time horizon informed by the statistics of the country itself, that agency that's running SA statistics, in terms of the demographics, population growth, you know, et cetera, all that's completed, so that we do not exaggerate the energy consumption. I know it's very difficult, but to what extent has SA Stats been consulted to ensure that we do not miss out in terms of those predictions of what the country actually need to in that time horizon. I think I'll rest my case at this stage at the moment, and then perhaps if there's an opportunity for the second round, I'd like to raise other issues. But I think it's a job well done so far, and it will help a lot in terms of investment, opportunities, et cetera, et cetera, so that at least we can have something very, very coherent as far as policy formulation of energy is concerned in the country. Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. I mean, I have a number of questions. I don't know if I can ask them all at this stage, but I'll certainly try. I suppose you can stop me halfway if you need to. Firstly, what I would like to say is that this process has significantly improved from when it was first announced back in May. And I must actually commend the department on, in fact, taking into account some of the constraints around public participation and the fact that you have extended the timeline. So I do commend you on at least responding to that. There's a couple of problems that I have, though. I mean, the one is obviously, and I've made this known before, with regards to the technical advisory panel and who you chose to include on that technical advisory panel. I mean, it seems to me to be made up of people largely from coal mining industry or from your energy-intensive user groups. So, you know, and there's been no scope for renewable energy or people of that bent in there. So, and of course, those are the guys that essentially generate the assumptions and the inputs that go into the model. So if you've got vested interest at that stage, you're going to have inputs that are necessarily skewed as well. So I do have a problem with that. In terms of the actual parameters and some of the issues there, the first point that I'd like to raise is the question of externalities. And I know that in this, in response to some of the comments that the public has made, you've said that you will You've looked at externalities, but it's very difficult to monetize these externalities. I mean, I don't think that's good enough, though, because essentially we're talking about massive externalities here. And I just did a study too last week to Gauteng on the acid mine drainage problem in Gauteng. Now, this is something that has to be quantified and has to be monetized when comparing different energy technologies. If we don't do that, then the cost to our society and the cost to our economy will be largely externalized and will not be included in this modeling exercise. So I'm just interested to see how you will, in fact, bring those parameters in. It is something that, really does need to be looked at. The issue around future energy demand, I've just been looking at the CSIR paper, and I see the difficulties they have in modeling future energy demand based on the fact that the only parameters that they've got as input is from Eskom. Have you given an actual parameter around future energy demand? Because this is going to determine everything, and this is something that we've got wrong in the past, terribly wrong in the past. And so how are we going to make sure that we get that figure right? Because that's going to determine a lot going forward. Then one of the big things that I really do want to take up is your parameters on energy efficiency. Now, initially you had energy efficiency targets of only 8%, the assumption that we were only going to reach 8%, which was about half of what we in fact have set as a government target of reaching energy efficiency. And of course that changes your parameters around base load requirements and that. Can we not set, in fact, the assumption of at least 12% energy efficiency by 2015? Is that not something that we should be aspiring to? I think we could even push that up to 15%, and that will change your parameters as well. Then the other issue is just around the cost of nuclear. The issue around there, I mean, I see that you've taken your cost from the EPRI study, which is fine, except that what we've seen is that particularly the cost of new build in nuclear is substantially higher than that was quoted in there. And if you look at the experience, say, of Areva in Finland, you see massive cost overruns. And I think we need to be realistic about the costs going in, and we need to really model the right cost in terms of that. Also, I mean, I suppose you could look at the Eskom tender and see what prices were put in terms of the tender. That will give us a good indication. And then just on the nuclear side as well, I see here when it talks about decommissioning, you say the discount rates discussed over a long plant life, the decommissioning cost will be discounted to a trivial amount. Well, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, if you look at the Sellafield nuclear plant in England, it's costing £80 billion to decommission that plant. This is a substantial amount of money, and I don't think it can be trivialized away with the discount rate. We need to look at what the full cost is to this economy over the next 40 years when considering different energy technologies. But I've got lots more questions, but I'll leave it there for now because I'm monopolizing. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm from the Public Enterprises Portfolio Committee, so I will focus a little on Eskom and what Eskom is doing. We are here as a direct result of Eskom and their poor management of the excess electricity at the time when they sold it at a discount rate to aluminium smelters. I see on page 15 that the aluminium industry is going to use 500 or 400 times more electricity than what they are using now in the year 2035. I would like to know if these discounted rates that you also talked about in your report, if they were also worked into the scenarios here, and why companies like the aluminium smelters do not generate their own electricity. Because if I was a big company like that, I would want to make sure that my energy supply is constant and it's there. But you know, I spoke to somebody from a big aluminium company, and they actually told me that, you know, it's so cheap. Why would we build more? Why would we build more capacity? We are not in the generation of electricity. So I told him, I said, why don't you give Eskom the 200 billion rand to build the electricity so that they could be the security of supply? And then they said, well, they would think about it. I mean, Eskom, go and ask them for the money, please. They are going to use all our electricity, and they are not paying for it. So I will just focus on that. And I just want to know if that was worked into these scenarios you have. Because if you look at the CSRI report, it's all assumptions. Nobody wants to give them the right information. Why not? Why do we have to make decisions on assumptions and guesses and some other person's report? I mean, they have all the information. We live in a technology age. You can press the button and you have everything. So why don't you give them the right information to base these facts on? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. As you know, I'm from the energy portfolio, and we've just had a very successful trip to Mozambique, where we unfortunately found out that the production of ethanol is zero, and you will remember that incident. My colleague is from the Public Works Department. Chair, my question is just in regard to the consultative process that was used. And as we saw, many respondents strongly opposed to nuclear and coal as energy solutions in future, and it says approximately 45%. I would just like to have perhaps a breakdown in terms of opposition to coal and opposition to nuclear. As we all know, there is no doubt that South Africa needs to extricate itself from their dependence on coal. But just in terms of the opposition to the nuclear ideology, I would like to have more specific percentage on that. Thank you.
Ask questions, raise issues, but as well propose that why don't you look at this percentage and all that. So I wish all the members can do that, in order that you must assist them as well maybe to look at other issues. Ross? Pandale? Okay. It's a proposal of the right information. Sure. The next one is Dexter.
Thanks, Chair. If we as the MPs are going to exercise oversight on things such as, you know, these decisions about electricity supply mix and so on, then we need some degree of transparency and accountability on the RP2 decision-making process and the content that I think hasn't been the case up until now. Obviously, I agree with my colleague, Mr. Khalen, that it looks like it's changing. But the jury's still out. The department refers to this decision-making tree in its documents. So I assume that this means that there's a way to evaluate different scenarios for the electricity supply mix. If that's going to happen, then that tree needs to reflect multiple criteria that would come into such an evaluation. I mean, in each possible energy mix, there'll be all kinds of different trade-offs, depending on which are the policy objectives that you have. So it's going to be important to know what the evaluation criteria the department proposes to use and how it suggests different priorities should be weighted and balanced. An example, what approach will the department use to balance, say, the needs of communities who don't have access to electricity against the interests of multinational companies like my colleagues referred to who have smelters and who run these big smelters? What's the way in which you do that? What factors will the department be considering? Without information on the criteria and how they'll be applied, then no one can really contribute on what should go into a provisional new electricity bill program. So beyond just sharing the information with us, the department needs to take input from different experts and stakeholders, including this committee. So can the department outline how it will develop its decision-making criteria and methodology and make these available for comment? Consider that this needs to be done within the next 10 working days, because that's the timeline that you've advertised.
Thank you. Chair, a couple of questions. First of all, in terms of renewable energy, the World Bank is prepared to give us $250 million and the African Development Bank as well. Now, the question is that have those funds been secured
And how far is the project of commercializing the scale of renewable energy in the country? Now, we know for a fact that renewable energy is an expensive exercise. What I would like to know, and this ties up with a question previously asked on nuclear energy. Now, the nuclear energy, we are only looking at the production besides the Quebec at a much later stage, around 2020, to commence. Has there been a study done regarding the cost of nuclear energy and the cost of renewable energies? Because I see we are saying they're both expensive, but I don't see a comparison, a comparative study done. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Three very short and to the point questions. I want to start with the presenter's last remark that you made, namely that your public participation process on your timeframes and getting a balance between or preventing deterring investment decisions is a very fine balance. Your time frame that you present to the joint committees are extremely tight. Literally, you have 120 days left until you get to the promulgation of the IRP. So, and then you in this, you have two public participation processes, including executive approval. Are you confident that this time frame, that you will be able to stick to it, and that you will be able to not to defer investment decisions after the end of this year? That's my first question. Secondly, I just want to hear your analysis. Eskom's proposed revenue application, the multi-year price determination, it is said that it is not aligned with the policy objectives of this IRP and the priorities of the department, especially referring to the diversification of energy mix and the reducing of greenhouse gases emissions. What is your comment on that one? And my last question, how far is the process of introducing independent power producers, especially those involved in the renewable technologies? Thank you.
There was a first round, so I'm not sure whether you're ready with the responses. But I think as the last one, it can be on the first round. The consultation process, as you say, it is through website, internet. I mean, those who don't have the WW, what do they do? Especially the majority of those that I represent in any way. Because it's people who are poor, who stay at the township and rural. How do you reach them? Was there any trial to see how then you deal with those people, because it's quite good whatever WW, but with the current situation in South Africa, not every or the majority of the people are not yet on that.
Okay. Yes, thank you, Chair. I was just going to request that the soldiers then they must take their arms to the battle.
We will share the questions, so I'll give the most difficult ones to him. Starting with the comment around the Chair, there are about 25 questions. I'll fly through them if you don't mind, otherwise it takes too long. Consultation with internal stakeholders, Chair, we omitted to indicate that ESCOM and other government departments are an integral part of this IRP process. In fact, we have an interdepartmental structure that sits every week on this matter, and that's how the consultation goes about, and ESCOM is involved in this IRP process. The issue of the time horizon and how it's influenced by demographics and for example, states as the SA, we capture that in the demand projection, right? So that in relation to economic growth or demand growth for electricity. This factors in, for example, the fact that there is demographic changes on the ground, which then influence economic activity and so on. Your experts in modeling and that, you know, the economists do very fancy models in order to determine the correlations and otherwise of those kind of relationships. Just regarding the compliment, I think we take it to heart. It's not very usual for this committee to, the committee does not issue compliments easily, but I think more seriously that we're working as hard as possible to improve. We're not saying that this process is, you know, is perfect. There are certain improvements there, particularly time-wise and so on, that we think we need to do that. The issue of the technical advisory panel being dominated by the EI, UG and the likes, excuse me, and they generate the input parameters. I think two issues. Firstly is that all the input parameters are transparent and they're on the website. Right? So if anybody believes that the number, to the extent that it can be quantified, should be 7 and not 6, right? You can completely dilute the influence that could have been effected by somebody from the EIUG. That's the first point. But even more importantly is the fact, and we've answered this question numerous times, is that the process of developing the integrated resource plan tends to be a lot more technical than anything else. The expert panel, the reference group that we use, is largely dominated by engineers and by economists. In relation to that as well, it is a little bit misleading to assume that it is dominated by the energy-intensive users group. We have an extremely vociferous particular panel member who represents, if you like, the IPP community, renewable energy and non-ESCOM. Right? And in fact, it is more that influence from him that is, you know, a little bit, if you like, more contentious, is more unbalanced, because the sense is that we have to be very careful of coming across as a business as usual kind of, you know, process. We have to make sure that we are confident, or rather that we are aligned, you know, with other imperatives in government. In fact, it is not even a secret that government's own industrial policy action plan is biased towards a green economy. Right? So it would be irresponsible of us. Actually, I think it would be a gross malpractice of us if we were not to take the renewable energy issue to the extent that it is a pronounced government policy position. If you read the IPEP, that is what informs how we deal with these matters. But equally, the flip side is that yes, the experts that have been doing this, unfortunately, tend to be EIUG and so on. ESCOM, the system operator expertise, is also brought in here. There's another concern that we have to deal with where people say this is an ESCOM process. Right? So that's the kind of environment we have to deal with as a department and to balance all of these those issues. On the one hand, this is ESCOM dominated. On the other, this is energy intensive users, or, you know, the coal industry dominated. What about the nuclear lobby? Is also very decided. It's like, where is the nuclear argument in all of this? So at some point you have to rely on a transparent process where you can then say, we think this is actually being influenced beyond what is reasonable. The issue of the externalities, very difficult one. We take the suggestion. The issue or the concern, though, around externalities is that there have been various attempts, both locally and internationally, to deal with the matter of externalities, and we are alive to those approaches as well. National Treasury has embarked upon a process which tries to quantify carbon emissions, as I indicated, by way of a proxy, the shadow price of carbon. And by their own admission, they got it wrong the first time. Right? So it was not, if you like, the instrument was not sharp enough, so to speak. The 2 cents per kilowatt hour levy that was imposed was supposed to be a proxy for what they regard as carbon emissions, that you must increase the cost of coal in order to reflect that. So it is something that we are still busy trying to deal with in a particular way. But what we are doing at this point, if you read our submission, is that we do have an approach in terms of which we deal with externalities. Economic impact is one of the other issues that we use in order to determine, you know, where, for example, costs might, you know, financial costs might be, you know, if you like, a more dominant condition or parameter in relation to the others. But it's a very difficult subject, is that. Just to correct the reference to the FIR demand, this document here includes, as one of the first submissions, a demand forecast. It is not done by ESCOM. It is done by the CSIR. ESCOM does their own as well. You will see here, in fact, I can read for you, there is a reference here to a comparison, right? In Chapter 4, by the CSIR, they say, relative advantages and disadvantages of the CSIR model versus ESCOM's official forecasting process. So they do a sort of peer review, if you like, as to... And the big problem in the past was that the integrated resource planning process was dominated more by ESCOM. So we've tried to counterbalance that by including, if you like, a totally, what is the word, not interested party, you know, a totally unaffected party. Energy efficiency target of 8%, and why not 12%? In fact, I think it's an issue that we need to correct, because the philosophy is that energy efficiency is quicker to deploy and it tends to be cheaper than supply side options. So it's not like we are too efficient. You know? So the idea is that we're going to harness as much energy efficiency as possible, right, until we have, you know, satisfied the cheaper options in relation to building. So there's no, it's actually a contradiction to think of an energy efficiency target. It's more like take as much energy efficiency as possible, and if it is in the plan, right, then it's a function of relative cost. So cheaper to build, sorry, to take off than to build, then that's the option we're going to take. The issue around these targets is that as a country we have been grossly negligent on this matter, that we have never been energy efficient in the past, and that's why it has become necessary to say, we think, you know, a target of so much by a certain time, you know, would be a nice thing to look forward to. But I think the IRP is very, in fact, the philosophy is based on energy efficiency being harnessed, not because we like it, but simply because it's quicker and it's also the cheapest option. And then the issue of nuclear and Finland and Areva and the ESCOM tender, there are details around it, but very quickly is that we have looked at a whole fleet, right, of nuclear costs. It is not, the ESCOM tender was based on a different generation to what we're looking at. ESCOM's technology or the bid was based on generation 3, and we're not necessarily married to generation 3, so that you have to compare apples with apples. Come on. Finland was a problem, but equally, the same entity that is building Finland has a fleet of more successful projects. You know, so you can't choose one that was not successful and say, look at the cost overruns, because we can show you 20 others that are being built, amongst others, by the Chinese and so on, that are a lot, I think. However, we're saying it is safe that we use EPRI as a basis, because their database is a lot more extensive than just one example. And this also relates to discounting. Those other economists might also debate the point that, I mean, nuclear power station lasts for 60 years plus, and you can refurbish, right? So the notion that you just much longer than that. Yeah. No, Quebec was built in 1985, but it's not going to be decommissioned soon. Yeah.
I just want to get that figure right, because, yeah, I mean, I'm surprised to hear of this longevity of 60 years. It was told in just 40 years. That was the lifespan of a nuclear power station.
Chair, if I could just respond to that. You can use 60 years safely. What tends to happen is that you also have a rehabilitation program, but the infrastructure will last, you know, for that length of time. You might have to change some of the components, you know, as and when, but by and large, I mean, a coal-fired power station, you build the financial basis, it's like a 30 to 40-year lifespan. But how many power stations are we running today that we built longer, much longer than 40 years? But the point is that discounting becomes an issue, and we also recognize that it's a very contentious issue that can be influenced one way or the other. But the issue of decommissioning costs in order to ensure that we treat, you know, all of those requirements fairly must cut across as well. Because the argument is also that you decommission coal mines, you also decommission coal-fired power stations when they reach end of life. It's not like you only decommission nuclear. The relative costs are high, but as a principle, you have to treat, you know, everything the same way. And if there is a concern that we're not doing that, we need to address that too. The issue of aluminium and how we have worked it into the IRP. As I indicated, we do have, and the way that this gets handled is that we have an industrial policy action plan. Right? In fact, we do have a parameter here that relates to energy intensity. Right? And the idea is that we recognize that we might have done certain things in the past where we have encouraged energy intensive industry in a manner that might not necessarily have yielded the economic impact. So how we treat the aluminium industry specifically is in relation to the industrial policy action plan, because in there we're saying that there are certain considerations, you know, how many jobs do you create, and so on and so forth. Right? So I don't believe that going forward into the future, the aluminium industry increasing the consumption is necessarily going to be on the same basis that we have entered into positions with BHP, Billiton, and so on. In fact, the contrary is true. The opposite is true, because they're trying to get investments in neighboring countries based on hydro, simply because they can't see their way through the South African energy situation. Regarding demand forecasting and the need for detailed info from Eskom, we do get information from Eskom, but as indicated, there is some concern about the extent to which the process then becomes dominated by one player over another. So you get information from different sources. For an example, if you do demand forecasting, the mining activity in the country is best obtained from the mining companies themselves. You know, so it's those kind of considerations, and but you would also check with Eskom as well. The nuclear coal opposition breakdown, I think we will need to go through those 800 submissions, and I think my colleague might be able to give an answer by the end of today, certainly not immediately, because we have to go into the database to disaggregate. Regarding the evaluation criteria, right? As we have indicated on our timelines, Honorable Dexter, is that we have not got to that point yet. The intention is that we have to look at, remember, the input issue. So we don't have preconceived ideas around what it should be. It's not like we have a set of criteria that we can then present to you and say, please consider this. We're wanting to say, this is a scenario. This is the economic impact of a scenario. What do we learn from that base case? Then we can be able to say, in fact, we think that the best way of balancing that triangle is in this particular manner, and that becomes a position that we would like to send out to the public in due course. So unfortunately, we're not in a position at this point to say that the evaluation criteria will be such and such. We're not there yet. Sorry about that. How far is the process of commercializing renewable energy? In fact, Chair, the short answer here is that the REFIT framework has been concluded, as you're well aware. The prices have been set and so on. At the moment, the two big issues that we're getting resolved, one relates to the matter of the buyer. As you're well aware, we managed to get the REFIT program funded in the multi-year price determination, so that's one tick. But the matter of who buys is an issue, and I think it relates to the question about the process of introducing the other IPPs, you know, the whole question of an independent buyer in relation to Eskom and so on. So those are the issues that are still outstanding, those two, the matter of the buyer itself, excuse me, but also the commercial, the legal arrangements around there. In fact, NERSA's evaluation criteria, public hearings were scheduled for, I think about a month ago, they have already been, the discussion paper has gone out. And once that is concluded, then we should be able to conclude the, or introduce the first renewable energy IPPs under the REFIT program. Cogeneration, some of them have already been signed, if you can call that the renewable energy that's already been executing as we speak. Have we studied the cost of nuclear in relation to renewable energy? Yes, we do have, and in fact, I think it might be in your submission here, we have what one can call cost curves in respect of the different technologies, because the cost can be looked at different, you know, levels. The one could be what we call overnight cost. In other words, if you were to build a thing now, you know, and just leave it here, what would it cost? But there's also another cost that's called life cycle cost. In other words, if you were to run this thing over its life cycle, you know, what would that relate? So somewhere we do have that information, and we can provide that in a lot more detail in respect of renewable energies and nuclear energy.
I think what I requested was has been a comparative study. I have looked at the document between the cost of the renewable energy and the cost of nuclear energy. But not only the cost, the sustainable provision of energy between the two.
With your permission, Chair, the matter of sustainability does definitely come into it. Well, what we also know is that one of the biggest, if you like, advantages of renewable energy is precisely that it's sustainable. You know, the sun will shine for as long as we are alive, and so on. Nuclear will require additional fuel and so on. So sustainability in that narrow definition, Chair, if I understand it, you know, we do make consideration to that, as opposed to, for example, coal, where we have a finite source and it tends to be an issue of climate change as a big consideration as well. Chair, but I hope that I have answered. If not, I can go into detail with Honorable Ajat later. The issue around timelines and whether we will not, defer investment decisions. I think our DG has indicated that we need to conclude this process by the end of, by the third quarter, right? And that's our marching orders, that we're working, and that's the promises that we make, that we're getting to that point. As for the other side, we are struggling, and perhaps with your support we can also get assistance, because this process that we have mapped out here in terms of consultation, we believe that it is perhaps the minimum consultation that we could do. We could spend a whole year on consultation, or an additional 6 months, you know, and we're hoping that perhaps in IRP 3, right, when we do this next round, right, we will take a lot more time because, you know, we will need to do that. But perhaps there might be another one, and I think it also relates to the question that the Chair has asked about what happens to those who don't have access to the internet and so on. The IRP should be a live process, a live document, if you like. It's not like now we're planning, now we don't plan. So we should be able to say, how do we bring in municipalities as an interface with the public in a manner that empowers the public wherever it might, you know, find itself, wherever the public might reside, so as to know, you know, what those issues are that are used as inputs into the process. Then you don't have a, you know, it's not like a switch where you say, now I'm consulting, now I'm not consulting. It becomes, you know, a continuous process that involves a lot more stakeholders in all the corners of this country. In fact, in other countries, how this happens is that it's not a top-down approach. They use a bottom-up kind of approach where it's the local plan that then feeds into the regional, into the, you know, and ultimately it cascades into the and I suppose that's perhaps something that we can build towards. Yeah, but you're 100% certain that we must be careful about compromising investment decisions in that, and I think we're confident that the deadline that has been indicated here, it just does justice to that. The ESCOM MYPD not been aligned with this IRP very quickly. By law, the regulator, as I indicated, licenses what is in IRP. So the regulator's tariff determination would then be aligned with this IRP. Right? So you're 100% correct. At this point, there's a misalignment because if you recall, IRP 1 was a window up to 2013. Right? So it made those investment decisions, allowed the regulator to make investment decisions up to that. But any investment decision beyond this would be premised on the regulator making the determination. In fact, in the scenarios that you might have read in the scenarios, one of the scenarios that we put in place is the one that says, you know, what are those immediate investment decisions? For example, what are committed projects and what are not committed projects? Do you start at Kusile or do you assume that Kusile, you know, and the alignment with the MYPD will then happen? And I've answered the last two questions around the IPP process for renewable energies and what happens to those who do not have access. Chair, unfortunately, you know, that's a starting point, and it's something that we would have to improve down the line. It's not just an issue of access, but it's also an issue of language, and we recognize that it's very difficult to undertake this process in a manner that satisfies all of those issues. As I indicated, the matter of the internet is in relation to this IRP process. We believe that we need to extend access to those that do not necessarily have access to the internet. That the options outside of the internet involve, amongst other things, municipal involvement in this process. Now, as I indicated, we already have certain fora that we use. I might have not indicated, but what we do is we have, as we do the electrification, as we undertake electrification, we have energy fora in all the provinces in the country. And twice a year, we convene an energy forum and we solicit, if you like, input from community members about those issues that relate to access, that relate to any matter in the energy space. It's not confined to electricity, incidentally, it's also other energy carriers. But that informs what the electrification plans would be. And the suggestion, Chair, is that that can easily be extended in order to cover matters that relate to the integrated resource plan.
All right, I hope you do that, you know, that you need to involve all the people, not a certain section in the communities. Otherwise, this will be just for people who are experts, engineers, economists, etc., and then the people then end up not accessing these the information to start with, because only English, speak, internet, whatever. But I hope we'll be able to deal with that. And the workshops, I'm sure, that they're having at the Energy Forum. I've never heard of it in any way, as a community person. I've never heard that there's an Energy Forum somewhere. I would have liked to take part as a community member, not chairperson of Energy. But in any way, make that information accessible and let people know when and where are these held. Let us take the second round of inputs, starting with those that have not participated and coming to those that are in the second bite. I see the hand of Honorable Boma, and then followed by Slau. Nchabeleng, are you raising your hand? Followed by Nchabeleng, and then we'll come back to... VD, shortcut. Voting district. Finale. Okay, and then Ross, Kweleng, and Mukwena. In that order. Mama?
Thank you, Chairperson. I think this is very technical, and it's quite a thing to wrap one's head around, but one does understand the urgency of what we are dealing with here, and I too have a concern about the time frames that we have, and you are assuring us that we are going to be meeting those. Can I also just ask a question which I don't think I've heard raised yet, and that is, regarding the, and you sort of intimated just now about the wind and the rain and the sun and sustainability, and we're dealing with climate change. I come from Durban. Our weather isn't the same as it used to be 20 years ago. It's different. And so we're having to deal with that. What is the position regarding the climate change policy and how this policy that, you know, we're now working on is going to fit in with that, if you could give us some indication of how that process is going to come together. Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I would also like to start by echoing the words of my colleague, Honorable Khreile, of commending the department in the work they have done. It is my view that this is a work in progress. Actually, this document is saying to us a lot of work that still has to be done. There are difficult questions to answer that are raised by this document, and the approach here is that it will be outcome driven, and we must appreciate the fact that there is the website, the special one for this process, which can be accessible. Two or three questions actually that I need to ask. The other two are located as one question. In the document, it is raised that part of the concerns raised by the people in the consultation process was the lack of capacity building, particularly in the rural communities, for them to be able to respond to complex and technical issues. And the second one is the inability to influence the existing government policies or decisions already in place, I suppose by the same communities. Is there a plan or does the department intend engaging into responding to these questions in action? In other words, not telling us that there is this thing, but is there a plan to capacitate the rural communities around issues of energy, which are so technical, I agree with my colleague here, and the issue that there are lots of decisions that government is taking, lots of legislation that is getting in place, lots of policies that are getting adopted in cabinet, and people do not really are not able to live with them. They don't understand where this has started, where they came from, and where they are taking the nation to. That is the first question, basically, with two sub-areas. The second question is the strongly opposed to nuclear people. You know, what are the people saying the problem is with nuclear for them to oppose it? Just to put it blunt. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chairperson. So this was going to be one of my questions, but, you know, can we get the details in terms of the objection? You know, the other I'd like to know is the is it slide 10? Slide 10 about the gap. But how long will it take to close this gap between our reality and, you know, that which needs to be done to improve our energy plans? Thanks. And then possibly, what will be the cost of closing that gap?
Thank you, Chair. My Chair, thank you that you've just managed to ask that question for me. So I almost said I was going to be trigger happy in asking the very same question. But mine was is just relating to your graph there of the short-term and long-term plan. That what are your immediate plans in terms of looking into mitigation of ensuring that the issue of the demand versus the available dispatch capacity that we meet all the gaps? And also, how does the other alternative renewable energy feature into ensuring that, you know, there's stability in terms of the demand versus the availability energy aspects? Yes, sir.
Yes, Madam Chair. Through you, you know, you talk about affordability, and then on the other hand you say that, well, in the past we were not very responsible with our excess, and people are still paying 12 cents or 12.3 cents for electricity, a kilowatt hour. And then you think, you know, I can't feel violated, you know. You sit there and you tell us, this is the plan, we're going to have a shortage, we have to get money for it, and then you don't address those issues in this plan to fix everything. You know, you say, well, those people have a contract, it's 25 or 30 years, they will keep on paying that. And so I, as a taxpayer and electricity user, I really feel violated. And now I need to know how you're going to solve the problem. And if it's not you that's going to solve it, who has to solve it? You know, it's like somebody going to gamble, and he gambles out all his wages, goes home, he tells the children, well, sorry, there's no food. You know, somebody, and next month he goes back again. You know, so there's no, you must make a mind shift change and say, we're going to fix the problems and then go forward. But this plan is, you know, it must be worked in there.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, Chair, taking the importance of renewable energy and the huge expectations regarding renewable energy from the public at large to see that we will make progress in terms of addressing this huge need for energy security in the country, I'm not sure if we should go into more detail on the discussions on renewable energy, but it seems to me that there should be more focus on renewable energy. And my question is simply to our panel, what is the selection criteria in terms of different renewable energies? Do we have clarity on that? And also perhaps the capacity allocation for each of those technology. And then perhaps a C-part to NERSA in terms of the renewable energy feed tariffs. How far have we progressed? What can we tell the public at large? When can we really see some substantial progress in terms of renewable energy? That would be the A part of my question. The B part of my question would be, perhaps, and I see we have the visitors from EDI also present, would be, and our panel has mentioned the active role of municipalities. Now, I don't want to throw the cat amongst the pigeons, because then we can speak for hours regarding municipalities, functional and dysfunctional, and what can they do and what can't they do and what should be the solution in terms of energy security. But just very briefly, that we've experienced in the Free State, where there was nearly an energy crisis, where there was a disconnection notice served on 54 towns by Eskom in terms of for paying electricity consumers, not where people are in default, but where people energy access were compromised, seriously compromised by the disconnection notice served by Eskom, and even advising them that they should make arrangements for alternative energy. So if we talk about municipalities, I think we need a whole day to see what we can come up with in terms of solutions, what works and what doesn't work, and perhaps just explain, sir, when you mentioned an active role of municipalities, the broader direction that we will enter into. To see that we don't compromise any energy security, especially for paying consumers. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Chairperson. Two quick questions that are interlinked. Number one, this government has implemented law through the good work of the Department of Energy to regulate the price of gas. The hope there is that the users of gas will then increase, and then with the effect that the effect of it should be that they are going to be swung over from using electricity. Now, in your economic model that you've put together here, have you factored that? In other words, there will be less consumption of electricity because people are now going to opt for gas, which is going to be cheaper because the people who are supplying gas who are just, charging a prohibitive rate with the result that people do not use much gas and use too much electricity. Now, in your projection, I know it's not a very easy question, but I mean, you should not exaggerate the fact that people are going to use more electricity. And the next stage, and therefore there will be a need for putting up more, a bigger fleet of power stations, etc., etc. So that's number one. Because there will be a shift, definitely, because of the affordability factor. Right, that's number one. Number two, the chapter said, the Exxon problem of, this big range of electricity charges by Eskom. It might not be reposing you, but I think they just raised it. And say that, to what extent have you factored it? Because, I mean, at one stage, there was a whole range of 4,000 different prices. If you're a farmer, you paid so much. If you're industry, you pay so much. Household, et cetera, et cetera, township, so much, et cetera. So whole bit. I know that has been reduced. Mr. McGuana came here and told us to build the Petroleum Committee on Public Enterprise that has been reduced. But there is still a disparity in terms of the rates, what people are charging. Different users are suggesting. And we know there's a philosophy that the rationale is that it depends where you are in the country, etc. Now, that's very complex because it means if people are far away from the power stations, then they must pay for their location, and which may be historical. And then that's going to, have an effect of displacement of population. We are going to run away from where they are and come and cluster around the urban areas, and that's going to cause further problems. I'm also coming up with a lay suggestion that just like a fuel. I mean, when in Joburg, you pay reasonably the same as when in Durban. I know there are slight differences, but they're not as big as when comes to electricity. So, in your economic model, have you factored those points? Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. Yeah, quite a few questions again. Your comments about that this must be an iterative process and that, in fact, we should review the IRP every year or so and come back to some of its assumptions. I mean, I certainly support that. My only problem with that, though, is that this IRP, I imagine, will lead to a set of decisions being made by government and entering into various contractual obligations, particularly if one looks at, say, for instance, the nuclear or coal-fired. If that decision gets made in the IRP now, then those contractual obligations will be entered into. And if the Protection of Information Bill goes through, you probably won't see what the terms of that contract is. But the point is that will we be able to then, if we review it in a year or two's time and come to the conclusion that, in fact, we don't want to proceed that route, will we be able to get out of those contracts? Because I think that is a real worry, that we're going to lock ourselves into an energy future now that we will be unable to get out of, even if a future IRP says that this isn't the right way to go. I'm just interested in your comments on that. The other issue, though, is, I mean, related to that as well, how have you modeled the kind of risk of building a huge power station and then say the future energy demand doesn't require that in the future, as opposed to technologies which you can roll out in modular form, say 100 megawatts, 200 megawatts, and so you can actually keep up with demand in that way? Have you modeled that kind of a risk in terms of committing yourself to a large-scale baseload as opposed to stuff that you can roll out in a modular way? Then the issue, I see that you did respond to one of the comments saying that you are going to model for the jobs in terms of the different technologies and the job creation. I'm just interested, how are you going to model for that? And how are you going to model for that in terms of our industrial policy as well? And the reason why I ask that as well is that have you looked at a certain threshold? Because what I'm hearing is that if, for instance, the targets or the what we dedicate towards a certain renewable energy technology are too low, then that's not going to stimulate the market enough to actually set up factories in South Africa to produce it. And so instead we'll end up importing turbines or importing solar panels. Have you looked at the threshold that is needed to, in fact, create, to kickstart that particular industry so that we can start building up those factories? Is that something that you've, in fact, modeled there? And then just lastly on the energy efficiency, I mean, I don't think that it's good enough to say that, you know, we'll take as much energy efficiency as we can get. I mean, the point is that this is a fundamental determinant of our energy demand going forward and a fundamental determinant which will affect as to what baseload power we need in the future. So we actually have to model this, and we can't just come with a nebulous figure and say, oh, it would be nice if we can increase that. I mean, one IRP I looked at in the States, for instance, has in fact modeled 4,000 different inputs with regards to energy efficiency and has compared those to different baseload generation technologies, something which we clearly haven't done yet. But we need to get more serious about energy efficiency, something which I'm sure you would agree with, and I think that we need to up that target and actually achieve that and put that into the model. We cannot go in with a low energy efficiency target as it is presently. Thank you.
Thanks, Jefferson. I think all of us have debating in the budget vote. And we say some of a lot of things that we see what we want to go to in this country on energy. Mine will be on page 11 about the renewable energy white paper. I want to know on what time frame will the department work on the review of the current policy, and also what will be the target areas in the country and which provinces it will be. And I think also when I'm saying that, but I also want to know what type of criteria they will be used. There is a project in the West Coast, in Darling. I think when we roll out, maybe in the future, other wind farms, we must really clearly look that project will really make a difference. Not you want only to start in projects, but not to make sure that also, at the end of the day, we must using taxpayers' money. And also to saying that, I must raise it in this meeting. We have a big public meetings, two meetings in the West Coast. On Saturday and on Sunday, where communities raise issues about, some people don't know this thing without reading, where people asking questions on the issue, climate change, but also the issue of energy. So on that issue, Chairperson, I want really to say, yes, we think we must really go to the rural areas. It's try, I know it's a technical part, but try to make means and ways and summarize it in a language where people can understand. Nothing, I know you use that deep English terms, but I think we have some dictionaries in this country. We have some dictionaries, and we have libraries here in this country where they can assist.
Yeah, just very quickly, I just wanted to know that when we plan for South Africa in terms of energy needs and the fact that we are so close in our development issues with the SADC region, what actually do we in fact bring into focus also what the needs of SADC are because of our interlinkage of South Africa's development with the development of the SADC region. Do we actually do that?
Okay. From the member's side, I think those are the questions. I'm not sure because we've got to close by 1 o'clock. Just a small one from myself. In pursuant of the mixed energy policy, given the assumptions and the modeling, etc., and all that, what is achievable within this life of this government? Because we are talking 20, 30 years, I mean, to come on, but surely governments come 5 years and all the others, but you have to bite the bullet in any way and just make for long term. Because those, the problem is that the long term goals, objectives are not quick fix things that you do it now, then you see it. So in that, you should have a way of how then do we deal with the other challenges. But as a developing country and other needs, how then do you balance these? Because you've given us all these, but it doesn't come out clear as to, given what we have and what we want, when we want to go, this is attainable within which period, etc. Because whether you talk about it openly or not, but it's in between here. Because we've got minerals, we've got coal, we've got others, surely. You are committed to renewable energy, but you can't just dump that now and say stop everything you do. I didn't hear you talking on the phasing in then of the other, because to me, the renewable energy is not cheap in terms of technologies that we talk about. Good, yes, we've got the sun, we've got whatever, but I mean, who deals with the solar panels and the cells now as we speak? And it cannot be that then we encourage to use China and others, but as they've asked, what does the international agreement say in terms of manufacturing here? And what incentives then are put in place then to make sure that you can then get those people to invest? But surely it can't be that we just import. That is not going to assist us with the unemployment we have and all that. There should be something binding from these people who will be dealing with the pilot project then to make sure that they can invest in this country and make sure that we can import so much, but we must put it in terms of those things. so that we are not ongoingly, going to have to boost other economies and not ours. So I didn't hear that clearly as to how you're going to deal with it, but to me that's quite key and fundamental, because as much as we like to go renewable energy all out, in terms of the budget, and especially from your department, we're struggling with your strat plan to say how we're going to do this and that, the cost thereof, and how then you go on with others within the energy mix policy, not only this one. What stories about the nuclear, 50% of people have got the right to talk in this country, but as far as I know, every other form of energy is dangerous. For us who use the electricity late, I must say, from a township, electricity was quite frightening. People would say, hey, this is, you must not play with the cables, you must not do whatever, but it's not as education on other forms. Whether solar, we're made to believe electricity is good and correct, but over time, we are seeing that, no. The same people who were telling us are now saying, no, use this. You've got an abundance of the sun. It's very good and all that. In terms of the international best practice, which countries? Water is used here as the infrastructure problem. I understand it to be that we are a water-scarce country. Unless you move out of that, how then do you deal with your slide, whatever, 18 concerns? But reality says we are a scarce using water country. We must look at it very, because we cannot go overboard with hydropower and all that. We can do so much limited to what we have in water. So how do you deal with those in terms of broadly issues that you raised here? I'm sure you get my point. Huh? Sure. Can you then get the responses?
Thank you, Chair. I'll simply just pick what I got from the last questions is the strategy for localization, how do we deal with the issue that we have, we are a water-scarce country. But I will request also my colleagues to assist me in the response. But let me just go back quickly on the issue of the climate change and the weather patterns and the policy. Our colleagues at Department of Environmental and Water Affairs are currently developing a climate change policy. And it is our considered view that we have to ensure that when that policy is finalized, we revise the IRP to respond to the new climate change imperatives, which will be government policy at the time. So that's basically our intention to do in this regard. I suppose most of the issues, if I can just request that you assist me there, Ombi. Thank you.
The issue around the opposition to nuclear and what it was based on, by and large, it's a concern about nuclear safety, and it's based on fear in the event of an accident. Is what the opposition is driven by, but we can do a further analysis to give some detail as to what the sample actually did indicate. The question of how long it will take to close the gap, the energy gap, as it stands. In fact, based on projections of the economy, of GDP, and also the related electricity demand growth, we do not see that we're going to be able to improve the reserve margin. And the reserve margin is the gap between supply and demand. It's an indication of supply adequacy until the next baseload power station is introduced, which is around 2014, 2015. So that's the kind of timeline that is going to be very critical from a vulnerability perspective. But I must also indicate that even beyond that, if we continue to grow, and because that's what we're planning for, if we continue to grow the economy along the same lines, in other words, not even better, along the same lines that we are doing now, then chances are we will need another baseload power station by around 2018, thereabouts. So those are some of the, it's like there is an immediate problem now, and there is a risk in relation to 2014 and the possible delays around introducing a baseload power station that time. And then there is another tranche of risk, if you like, around the 2018 kind of vicinity. And the whole rationale, if you like, around the IRP is that it gets used in order to trigger those decisions that would be very critical for around 2018 and beyond. Just to paint the last portion of the picture, around 2022, most of the old power stations start getting decommissioned, which means you're starting to go backwards now, and you need a replacement plant to deal with that. So it's this problem of electricity capacity is going to be with us for a very long time yet. In terms of the cost, it has been estimated. I mean, you can make an assumption of about a $3 million per megawatt. Right. So if we need 1,000 megawatts, it's $3,000 million. That kind of $3 million. Yes, $3 billion and so forth. So you can work out just how much money, but it's a lot of money that will be required. That is on overnight cost. Now, if we go the other route, which is a lot more carbon friendly, so to speak, less emitting, then the costs become substantially, the capital cost becomes substantially more. Then you're starting to go into a lot of trillions. But we can do a further analysis on that chain if that is what is required. We take the point about the, if I understood the question correctly, about the contradiction in relation to smelters, excuse me, the affordability issue and so on. Two quick points. Firstly is that we recognize that cushioning the poor is a critical element in this. We're not suggesting that, you know, the build program will be funded and the poor will be left high and dry. There are measures, there are strategies to deal with that part of their, well, you can call it maybe 15% of the domestic sector, you know, needs to be covered or protected one way or the other. And I think Honorable Mugwena did allude to the issue of the tariffs and the tariff rationalization process in order to make sure that, for example, you have poverty tariffs, you also have, you know, industrial tariffs that are competitive and so on. So how you slice that is a process that we are undertaking with the regulator as well. But lastly is that that contradiction is a legacy issue. You know, so that is what we have done as a country. We have entered into contractual positions for the long term, or, you know, for longer than now, and it becomes a matter of negotiation in order to unwind some of those positions, and it is a process that is currently underway. What we're saying is that going forward, there would be proper alignment with our industrial policy and the growth path that has been set for the country. So the question about the criteria for the different renewable energy technologies is that, yes, that is a point that has come out very strongly, that we need to not talk just generally about renewable energy, but we need to differentiate. Very quickly, we have, and I think it also relates to the question that Honorable Ross, and Honorable Ross, I think there was a council member who made the comment, the question around the provincial location of some of these projects. You know, the fact that we have a lot of sun in the Northern Cape and in other parts of the country, and there is also wind in other parts and so on. So what we have now embarked on is to try and disaggregate these approaches in relation to wind, solar, thermal, solar PV, and so on, and on their own rather than as renewable energy, just like that. And in fact, that was the basis upon which the regulator pronounced different tariffs for those different technologies. So we are dealing with them. The matter of broader direction of municipalities, I think that was a fair comment, that we do not compromise energy security, you know, at that end of the value chain is something that we accept as a challenge. In fact, there is a lot of work, as we've indicated. EDI Holdings is also seized with that initiative, not only from a, you know, let's plan for the future, but also from a let's address the legacy problems as well. An excellent point was made around the need, or rather that we must avoid over-exaggerating demand growth as people do switching to other carriers. We are also alive to that process, that the electricity plan looks at the electricity aspects also, but in time, as we indicated, I think it was earlier in my slide presentation, that the integrated resource plan would then allocate some of these things, we believe, in the appropriate locations. And space heating, cooking, for example, you know, it's very clear that it does not belong in the electricity space. It needs to be migrated to other more efficient carriers like LP gas, and as such, it will impact electricity demand growth. That has also been taken into consideration when we do this. I've mentioned the issue around the different tariffs and how we factor them into the IRP model. The IRP looks at the supply. We needed to indicate that the IRP excludes the distribution infrastructure issues. If you look, there is a parameter here that relates to distribution. So we treat distribution as a problem on its own. What the IRP seeks to do is to say, how do we balance supply and demand and diversify away from coal, right? And then solve that problem of having enough supply. But the value chain also has transmission and distribution issues, and that is something that is a body of work on its own that is not necessarily factored into this aspect of the integrated resource plan. But ultimately, you will have the integrated resource plan looking at infrastructure as well, and be it transmission or distribution infrastructure, be it pipelines, be it whatever else, and that's how the model is going to be improved to deal with that. And then the matter of the IRP2, to the extent that certain contractual positions will be entered into, and it might be difficult if we lock ourselves into a particular energy future. I think that is something that is, you know, it's a process that unfolds. I think it's fair comment that certain decisions need to be made. Like yesterday, investment decisions around renewable energy in particular will be made like yesterday, and that's why we need this IRP. But there are also decisions that would need to be made around baseload going forward. And I want to link that with the comment around, you know, the big lumpy investments as opposed to distributed smaller generation options. And so I think it's a balance between all of those options. And maybe to link this also with the renewable energy white paper review process, and the question was I think Honorable Moss asked the question, was that all of those things go into a mix. And the renewable energy white paper process made provisions up to a certain time, and it needs to be, for example, there was a target. I think there was another question about where we are, but 4% diversification from coal is the target for renewable energy up to 2030. That's a 10,000 gigawatt hours. What the renewable energy white paper review process is then supposed to do is to say, beyond that, what is government's stance as to the target? And naturally, that goes into the IRP. So it's an integral part of the IRP process to say, in 2020, what sort of, you know, mix do we want to see, and how much percentage would come from different energy sources outside of coal. So that's how this thing is going to solve some of these problems. But then the matter of distributed generation becomes, you know, part of that equation, because most of renewable energy projects tend to be relatively smaller and they're distributed all over the country, and that way we will avoid or will improve energy security, because it's not going to be in big 600 megawatt packs, but also supported by smaller generators all over the place. In fact, there's an additional point around this, and it's the fact that down in the Cape there is not much generation going on, and it creates stability problems, and therefore with the smaller generation it will solve that. Economic modeling. The Department of Economic Development is an integral part of this IRP process. And as I had indicated earlier on, is that those scenarios that we would have decided upon, the whole spectrum of scenarios, each of them would be modeled from an economic impact point of view. The model is currently available under the auspices of the IDC, the Industrial Development Corporation. But what the Department of Economic Development is doing is to customize it to certain parameters that they would also like to check. And in fact, only yesterday we had a discussion around how ready they are and just what some of those issues are. But that's as far as the logistics are concerned. As to the detail and all of that, fortunately, I'm no expert on those, so I'm not in a position to say how the detail is that is going to be unfolded. Yes, and I take the comment around the energy efficiency target and that we need to model that. In fact, there is an energy efficiency strategy, but I was just trying to illustrate the kind of problem that we had. But going forward, yes, we do need to model that in relation to the supply side options, like you've indicated other countries too. I think I've answered the question about the target provinces. That depend. We've done an energy, a renewable energy resource assessment for certain technologies, Honorable Mosso, and this is what informs, for example, the fact that the solar resource in the Northern Cape is perhaps the biggest in the country, and it has been extended to some of these things. There's also a process to look at biomass and so on, so it will then indicate what sort of provinces or target provinces and the criteria as to where we're in. We take the comment about the Darling Wind Farm and how these projects need to make a big impact. And also the comment about, I think we've heard it numerous times, that climate change issues are also relevant to rural communities. It's not like, you know, it's not a technical matter only, this IRP thing, but there are those issues. And certainly that's a gap that we need to find a way of closing. We do consider SADC. There is a parameter that relates to imports, and as we plan this, Honorable Hajjaj, we do take into account what the needs are in the SADC countries. In fact, two-sided. The one is that we export to them, but we also wanting to generate those cleaner technology options in Mozambique, in Angola, and so on. So we do take that into account. What is achievable in terms of diversifying our mix during the term of this government? The short answer is that the target for renewable energy was set at 10,000, which is 4% by 2013. But we think that there is a lot more appetite. There is a shortage to such an extent that perhaps that target is going to be exceeded by 2014. So we might see ourselves at around a number higher than the 4%. But in fact, this IRP will address that particular problem, because the model will then balance the triangle as to cost, affordability, externalities, and then we'll be able to. But I think it's safe to say it will be more than 4% is what can be achieved. 4%, yes. At the moment it is zero. Just to give it some context, at the moment it's zero. There's nothing to talk about. So 4% is a very substantial number. Do we have a strategy to bind international investors to localize? Yes, Chair. The integrated, sorry, the industrial policy action plan does direct us to do that, but it is something that, I mean, this is just a plan. The implementation of the plan is where we have to be careful about making sure that we do force investors to localize some of these investments. I think that covers it all, Chair. Thank you.
All right. Those were the answers given and comments and proposals. I think we have reached the end of the meeting now, and it's about, what, 5 to 1 or 8 minutes to 1. I think what then after this, you're still going through with the processes. I'm sure there'll be space that you have to put into our program, the two committees, and see. Because we wouldn't like you to come with the final product, because we are also stakeholders as members of the committee, so that we can then try then to get, after the second process, then we are able then to say, this is how we look at things. So that means we'll have to look at our programs, public enterprise and ourselves, and then come back to you. Okay. DJ, I'm not sure whether I've got the last word or what you are covered. Okay, public enterprise? Well, you are adequately covered. All right. Okay, then. And then the next meeting, I think we are having on the 10th, the briefing on the energy efficiency strategy. That is the energy committee, as well as the CETAs, the CETAs. The two CETAs are still on for next week. And then on the 11th, we've been invited by Trade and Industry. They are discussing EPUB 2 and related to ESCOM and climate change issues. So they've invited us to take part because we are energy committee and it is linked with what is going to be discussed. I hope, I'm sure public enterprise is also invited so that we can have the three committees then taking part. So make sure that in your programs we've got only the 10th, the energy committee, you don't have the 11th. So if you can include the 11th then for that EPAP process, which is what the ACTD just said that they are going to factor in some of the proposals to them. Yeah? All right. And then going forward, I think then the 24th is we'll be having the hearings on the liquid fuels charter, the energy committee. The adverts will be on the newspapers, ne? Soon. This weekend, we'll have the adverts and then we'll hear public comments and people who want to participate. But we hope that we'll use the 24th. If needs be, then we'll look at the days, whether the one day will be enough or we need 2 days. But I think we had a good meeting, and as Lau said, there's it's like the work in progress of this particular issue. But this is not just a simple policy matter. It's quite critical because it's talking about a lot of other integrated sectors here, and we hope that we do work with other departments to deal with this. Otherwise, then, I think we declare the meeting closed. Silao and Moss, if you can come here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.